The information presented in this podcast is not intended for the treatment or prevention of disease or any medical condition, nor is a substitute for medical advice. The information contained herein in this podcast reflects only the opinion of the author and presenter and is in no way considered required practice.
Welcome to Motivation and Muscle, the podcast that connects your brain to your brawn.
Hi, this is Eric Fiorello, and I want to welcome you to Motivation and Muscle. This is a podcast show that connects your brain to your brawn. Today is September 30th, 2014, and we are brought to you by and sponsored by Fiorello Barbell Company here in upstate New York, where we're not the biggest, but we're the best. And our motto is, we don't try, we succeed. And today, this is great because I've got another guy that I admire and has helped me out in the past. And we're going to have him on every week until he doesn't want to do it, and I hope that never happens. We got Steve Helmicki, Mr. Primordial himself. We couldn't be happier to have Steve on today. And we're going to tackle an issue that I've got from a lot of listeners, and I'm sure Steve has, being that he's in this business. Injuries to the knees and the other joints on the body. Steve's going to talk about that with myself and the experiences and what he's done to get people back. So, Steve, welcome to the show. And, for anyone that hasn't tuned in yet, give us a little bit of what Primordial is, and we'll move on with the show.
So besides a national certification that's National Academy of Sports Medicine and Cooper's Institute approved, and it's been sold to the Marines and a number of schools, we have a standalone facility in Elma, New York. I see about 140 private client sessions a week, everything from people that are 80 all the way to athletic preparation to kids that are very young. And a lot of our business, I would say probably about 40% of it, is post-physical therapy work.
Mm-hmm. Let's get right into this. We got a lot of people, especially I've been getting a lot of notes from people with knee injuries. Now, some have had to have surgery. Some are kind of hobbling. They want to get back into the lifting game. But they're not really sure. They're trying all kinds of things, bouncing around. And I'm sure this is something with the athletes. You got young and old, especially with the football guys. What happens when you get somebody into your establishment, and let's just say they didn't need surgery, but they got a pretty good whack on a knee, whether they fell or they twisted it or, somebody cut them right down. How would you approach something like this, either with an athlete or a non-athlete, Steve?
Well, range of motion improvement is probably the single most important thing that we start out with, but it's an assessment. I try not to overlap the medical community too much, so anything from a severity standpoint, we certainly want orthopedic input. Mm-hmm. That said, I would say that knee injuries are more common than ever, so it's really not uncommon for kids that are freshmen in high school to have multiple meniscus repairs already, which to me is very problematic. But I think for most people, since it's so common now, it's really considered part of the process of playing competitive sports, even on a little loop in high school level. So the thing I would say outside of the building, and what I see is that people don't take a close look at, is the elected stances and positions in a lot of games, especially football, with the toes pointed forward and a huge anterior shift of the weight load on the knee, is one of the most significant problems I see in what starts to erode knee joints. Not only the constant up and down in that position eroding the meniscus, but the position that the feet are in on the field that makes it more susceptible, because it's so deeply attached and the knees are pitched forward that even if a subtle hit comes to the side, it has a tendency to rupture the tendons and ligaments. So
when we get to that point, though, I guess the other question is this. You know this, obviously, because you've been around this for so long, and you see these things happening more and more. I guess two things is this. If I had a son, or if I was playing ball and I came to you and I said, Steve, I need some work here, would you automatically set me right up to get those knees a lot stronger and healthier rather than we wait till we get hit and hopefully we don't have to have surgery and we rehab it that way? And also, too, has the game gotten too damn fast? Is that what's – I mean, you know – let's think about this. 30 years ago, yeah, I guess there's probably the amount of injury there is because we talked about this a little bit last week. But is it that much faster that, or is it just that, you know, we're slapping these kids out in the field and saying, you know what, go at it?
Well, I'll answer the last question first, and this is just in my opinion. I don't think you should be – there's a hesitation still domestically to start training kids early on. But no one has an issue with having them run full speed into each other. And I don't mean training by the crap that you do on the football field in preparation where you do your push-ups and your sit-ups. But I mean systematically starting to train them, even if it's PVC medicine balls, and starting to strengthen the tissue. So I would say that there is an absence, especially in my area, of lack of preparation until it gets serious, maybe between sophomore, junior, and senior year. So there's an actual lack of preparation as far as strengthening the body enough to withstand the contact. You know, have aspects of the game gotten faster? Certainly, but there's a lot of set of circumstances that create those injuries. I mean, I think turf is, you know, one of the single most egregious things, you know, besides the gases that come up from that, from a breathing standpoint, the fact that the footing and how hard it is, it creates a lot of injuries. There's very few grass fields left now, and because of the wow factor of having turf, look at most of the training facilities, even indoors. They're putting turf indoors and having people repeatedly run on those ad nauseum, you know, without taking a look at volume and control of what's putting put on the kids' bodies.
Yeah, because, you know, as you and I both know, when you hit that turf, it's like hitting cement.
Yes.
I mean, who wants to sit there and hit cement all day? You know what the problem is, too, Steve? There's such a, you know, everybody, let's face it, everybody wants their kid to make it to the NFL if that's what you're doing, playing ball. But at the price of what, you know, I go to high school football games, obviously, because my brother-in-law is the coach. And you see parents there, and, you know, they're almost like frothing at the mouth. I mean, you know, God help the kid if he didn't catch the ball or he caught it and slipped and fell. You know, I mean, it's like the emphasis isn't on – and I don't think enough people know about this. The emphasis isn't, like you're saying, with preparation to getting these kids in the gym and working with them on these joints, which is more important than anything. But it's more of an emphasis is, hey, my son or daughter is great here, and they're going, you know, Division I, and they're going to be playing for the New York Giants, you know. So I see it more like that, too.
Well, there's no doubt. There's an enormous amount of drive factor, and a lot of what's being coached is a bad militaristic format. So the preparation is not so much preparing the body to play properly, but it's preparing the kid's mental toughness by beating the crap out of the body. And like we've discussed, I think, a few times in the past, everything you do puts a strain on the nervous system that you're doing in preparation. And if it's not done in fundamental good mechanics, you know, you have serious issues. And I think one of the other major flaws is electing the same stances, the same width of stances, with kids with completely different femur lengths, and then trying to adapt a single-handed viewpoint about running mechanics.
I mean, everything is like one size fits all, right? We're doing here
exactly, and that's why those very large group training models have a tendency not to work, because you can't correct specific to the person's length of back, and all of those things. Besides a safety issue, putting a kid in his most powerful position makes them a better football player. There's very few people or whatever sports they're playing. So whatever it behooves anybody that's coaching to actually treat the kid as an individual and adapt their mechanics to what you want from an output on the playing field. And I don't think we see enough of that, because it's time consuming, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes patience.
And I think, you know, this is something I've always thought about it. It's an assembly line. It really is, man. You know, when you got one size fits all, what you do and what I do are going to be two different animals. And you know, chances are, if it works, we get real lucky. But on the opposite side of the coin, one of us could get hurt really badly. And that's, you know, who wants to see a kid shatter his leg when he's a freshman? You know, chances are he's probably not going to come back for a while if he does. Plus, you know, we haven't even tackled the mental end of this. You know, you get smashed like that, you know. And I know, like, when I went to Iceland, when you worked with me in eight, when I tore that bicep, you know, I had heard of so many people, Steve, that couldn't ever come back mentally from something like that because you were afraid. I'm not going to say I wasn't afraid the first time I picked up a stone, but I wasn't afraid where to pick it up. It was more of the fear of, is this arm stable enough now, or am I going to tear something else? And that's a thing that I don't think people address enough, is the mental, I don't know if I want to call it anguish, but there's things that happen to you, and sometimes that little game gets replayed over and over in your head. So, you know, it's more than just physically getting the crap kicked out of you and getting hurt, you know?
Well, absolutely, and I think anguish is a good term. I think any time that you're competing in anything on a high level and any kind of devastating injury comes, despite the fact that even surgically it can be repaired to as strong or stronger than it was prior to that, it's very hard for those ghosts in your head to disappear, the memories of how that feels when it happens. Yep. And subsequently, I don't care who you are, the people around you are going to continue to harp on you because of the injury, and that puts a tremendous amount of pressure.
And here, all right, well, here's what I want to do here now. Say obviously I'm gonna come to you and I'm gonna say, you know, I want you to train me one on one if you can do it. Are we going, you know, I know what you did with me and how we did different variations of things. Are we gonna, if let's just concentrate on the knee right
sure.
now. I come in, okay? I tell you what happened. We didn't need surgery, and you know, I show you all the stuff from the doctor, so we're all good with that. You've seen everything. And you've decided to take me on. Are we going initially, are we going to go body weight? Are we going to go back to, I like calling the big three, which I know you're probably not going to use some of this, but I'm going to say it anyways, a squat, a deadlift, and you know me, I'm an overhead guy.
Yes.
How are you going to take me, and you know I've hurt my knee, and you know I want to be ready for football in the fall, and you've got me, say, for 10 months. What am I going to do? I know you're probably going to step on my head a little bit, too, because you know I'm going to need it, because I might be aggressive, but you're probably going to see me, like, at times drifting off, or maybe I'm going to be like, I don't think I should do that because you're going to hurt my knee. What are you going to do to me, Steve, to walk in there initially?
So the first thing I would do is gather any medical information that's necessary. The second thing, I would warm you up the same way that I typically warm anybody up. We use very small rectangular yoga blocks to do total knee extensions. So not only are we doing glute activation, but we're tracking the patella tendon at that point. So once and then the glute medius is developed. So we're trying to take a look at mechanics to make sure that the knee is going over the toe line properly and where the body weight is on the foot. So heels should not be separating. Very common for people that are squatting down, even in athletic stance, to have their heels separated from the ground and then have a complete anterior shift of the entire load of themselves and whatever else they're doing on it. So the first thing is to identify how the foot places on the floor. So I like the body weight on the heel and pushed on the outside of the feet, no trail in, slightly toed out, and the knee going over the toe line. Once we assess that on the total knee extensions, and we check if there's not any glute activation, I start to do what some people would typically call a standing ab with a band, but I really let them do gravity pulls because I want the hamstrings completely stretched out. All those issues tie into the knees. A lot of people have very short hamstrings, so that slow gravity pull off the breathing starts to lengthen that up. The third thing after that is to bring it in and assess squat mechanics. So we have to find a way, even with a knee injury, for you to squat pain-free, and it is possible. So there's a way to elect the width of the stance, and I would do it body weight at first. This is probably one of the only things I would use something like the rings or TRX for, is to allow us to assess and put you in a position where you can squat without any pain. The minute you can do that and we can assess a decent squat position and you're sitting back without too much anterior shift, we're going to put the bar on your back. So that requires us really looking at you specifically closely, where that bar is placed on the back, The length of the femurs, the length of the back, and then how much anterior shift of the knee happens during the squat. So I really do not like much forward. Most people that squat, especially what I see, even people that are very athletic, they squat, they start to go down like they're going to kneel in church. And
I agree with you.
So the exact opposite is what's necessary from my perspective. And we've had very, very good results by starting that way with people and finding ways that they can squat.
Let me ask you this question. I mean, now you know how I do dead stop, and I'll tell you why I went to dead stop. Mainly, I was kind of bored with the regular squat, but I found one thing with the dead stop squat for me. Never went forward, because when you're sitting in the hole and you got to come up, your mechanics got to be very, very good, because if anybody who's never done this before, I've done it a few times, but not much. If you're not set properly and you try to come up, and you're off on one side, what do you think's going to happen at that point? The bar might come maybe an eighth of an inch, and you're just going to get knocked right on your can. So the reason why I went to that, mainly for the challenge, but I felt that was a lot safer for me to be able to squat a lot longer. I don't know if you'd go with that, Steve, but I've done pretty well with that, and I think it trains you in a different way.
Well, I like those. I mean, but it – The problem with that modality for athletics is that it's usually a shortened movement. So once and this is again only from my perspective and the way I do it, and that's not saying that it's it's the end all be all. Once the bar is established, I'm always going to combine body weight work with bar, but the body weight work is very different, and systema squats are very different than just doing your 20 reps or whatever number you choose. The movement has to happen in between the breathing. So despite it being called a squat, it really is a breathing exercise to remove tension from the musculature. So we talked a little bit about elasticity and flexibility before. Some of the inhibitions in people squatting properly and some of the pull on the knee is the way the tension is built in the leg structure. So if you can subsequently remove that properly through starting the inhale through the nose prior to the descent and going very slowly, and then not – disrupting the loop, but starting the exhale before the movement on the ascent, you get a completely different squat. So they say a lot that the movement has to happen in between the breathing, and there's a big difference. The breath will start to push you down and up that way, and then the musculature will almost be like you're slinking to the ground and back up. That has a tendency to lengthen the musculature out quite a bit, and we've had good results with that removing knee pain.
Well, let me ask you this too, Steve. I love isometrics in the cage, obviously, and I know that you're dealing with, say, a high school kid. Would you ever, once you got their knee pretty stable and stuff like that, would you ever have them doing anything where they'd be pushing through a set of rods, or do you feel that's not the course you'd like to take them? I mean, I'm talking from a full body strength.
No, I like
and
it.
Obviously. Okay. See, and I believe in those totally. I love doing those.
With anything though, it's where it when you're talking about systematic development of anybody, it's where it's placed in the course of everything you're doing. And the deeper you get into it, you're not subsequently just looking at what you need to do this week or what you need to do today, but if you're looking at the lifetime of athletic performance, then how those things are placed over that 4, 8, or 12 years of playing time makes an enormous difference over time. So it's all of those tools are important tools. It's just where and when they're placed, and that's really based individually. No matter how systematic your training, you have to adapt the system to the person that's in front of you.
And that's obviously it. I mean, we all train different. We're all built differently and all that. Okay, so we're through our knee now. I mean, what are you feeling? All right, we got 10 months with the athlete. What do you think we're talking about before you can get them – fully going, fully running? Obviously, everybody's an individual, and I mean, this is kind of a broad, canvas I'm talking on. But in your experiences, when have you seen the results start popping? Are we going early, 6 months? How are you going with that?
Well, it depends on what you mean by results. We see immediate relief. We see immediate improvement in movement patterns. That said, is the joint structure and the supporting muscle tissue strong enough to support full contact? That's really based on the individual. I let all of those things happen based on what we're faced with and what we have with the person. But, you know, fairly rapidly. I had one repair where I had a bucket handle meniscus tear in my ACL tour. Prior to me going to the Worlds the first time I came back from it. It subsequently ruptured. I have not had it repaired, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to find a way to squat and move that really doesn't bother it.
Now, Steve, do you when you squat, I mean, this is what I wanted to ask you, too. Obviously, I know you've done them. This is going to be a question I can hear people right now in my ear. Why not the front squat? And I know why, because of the way the knee is. But once you're fixed – is there more benefit to a lifter or someone that's playing sports? Let's forget about injury right now. Let's talk about either a high school, a 20-something or a 30-something that is a very good lifter. Maybe they're in powerlifting. Maybe they've decided they got the strongman bug. If you had to do it again and you were, you know, going back into powerlifting, or like even when you had the Husa steel, and, you know, basically that's a deadlift slash front squat anyways, in my opinion, what's more beneficial, you think, or is it just the athlete's structure, the way they're set up?
Well, we squat 3 times a week, so they're all beneficial. So I'm not opposed to front squatting. We front squat. We might front squat with kettlebells. We might front squat with a barbell. I use a lot of... if you've seen those big heavy D balls, and we have them now labeled for us all the way up to 300 pounds. So very much like squatting an inverse stone, I squat those quite a bit with people. So we do a lot of those movements. We don't stay. If I was going to run a squat routine, it might be four different rounds of squats on four different completely implements, all in variable method style. So there might be two rounds of squatting with a ball that's 60, 80, 100, 150, 200, 250, 300, two rounds of that, catch your breath, go to the barbell after that, squat with water bags after that, squat with the kettlebells front squat style, squat with the barbell front squat style. I mean, I use every single apparatus. We squat, everybody in here squats 3 times a week.
Wow, that's great. I mean, I've had this thing with people for years, you know, some people live and die by the deadlift. Some people live and die by the squat. I understand the whole thing about picking a huge object off the ground. I'm not adverse to that at all. But for me, I've always liked something sitting on my shoulders. There's just something about, I don't know. It sets me up different and sets me mentally different than a deadlift. I mean, you're coming from a background of those three lifts too. When you were competitive, or even now, and I know you do things different. I realize that totally. But do you feel there's more, or is it personal choice? Do you like the squat better than the deadlift, or do you just feel each are beneficial in their own way?
I'm
talking personally for you.
No, personally for me, I mean, I like them all. I mean, my least favorite of the movements was the bench press. Unfortunately, the deadlift numbers. I didn't put them on the platform where they were, but, you know, I pulled 675 for five, and then I pulled 815 pounds with the trap bar. So I mean, I like the deadlift, you know, and I was a pretty damn good stiff legger, but it just I like them both equally. The problem with when you get away with, for me anyway, from the there's two things. Psychologically, I don't play with the competitive lifts in the same way because
–
you just start to compete against yourself then in ways. Do I like the weight on my back, still doing like Heisies with the safety squat bar and stuff like that? Absolutely. Am I opposed to, you know, pulling reasonably heavy? Absolutely. I like both of those things. I would not say that one, you know, I think if you try to find that one exercise that's the king of all, and everybody's going to argue, whether it's the deadlift, the squat, the king and jerk, clean and jerk. I don't know. You know, I use every single tool and every single movement that efficiently helps all of us, so I can't pick one over the other. Everybody deadlifts here every time they train, too, and it can be kettlebells, it can be sumo, it can be your conventional stances. I mean, everybody pulls here, and again, it's done with every single kind of object. So those two things, I would say the of the three lifts, what we do almost zero or relatively infrequently is bench press. You know, I've become an overhead guy despite being a power lifter.
I agree with you because, you know, my old philosophy is always this. there's a few things you might do on your back, but let's face it, you're competitive in anything, you're going to be standing straight up.
Yeah.
So, you know, putting stuff over your head makes great thing. Now, that's nothing against the bench press, but, you know, if you told me it was a bench press or putting a big monster thing over your head, I'm going with the monster thing over my head. There's just certain things that kind of set you off, and it's, I don't know, I remember reading stuff by Perry Rader and those guys, and, you know, big supporters overhead, but it was just, you know, it was just something it did to you mentally, bodily, you know, having done it, I mean, I can testify to that. Now that we've gone kind of through the knee, you know, what you would do knee-wise, I'm going to just guess here, but if you had to talk about, which we're going to, a second area on the body that gets really battered and hurt, would we be talking probably the shoulder capsule? Or
absolutely.
Okay. Yep. All right. Now, this is going to be very interesting because, you know, anybody that's really been in the physical culture, you know, for years, and you ever read stuff, even, you know, I love getting all the old books from the 60s and, you know, the cannonball shoulders and, you know, you're seeing these guys hoisting up massive dumbbells. And, you know, you think back even in the day. Think about the way they used to build the handstands. There'd be how many people? 6, 7 on top of each other? Mm-hmm. Just think of the shoulder power alone besides full body power you had. Well, so now we get into something that none of us ever want to have is a shoulder injury because that can really screw you for a long time. So tell me what you're seeing shoulder injury-wise, and is it going to be a lot of it from these big flat benchers, or what are you seeing, Steve?
Yeah, I think if you look at the average athlete's body now, it's very much anterior loaded. So yep. So there's everybody wants to look big and strong from the front. It's more about appearance than functionality. So, you know, I really am a rear shoulder, rear delt, rear back attacker. So everybody in here does pullovers in every single way, including the old Nautilus first generation. It's a mandated structure. We've had great, great success in keeping the shoulder joint healthy on pitchers and, you know, top-level pitchers and quarterbacks. And then one of the easiest ways to stabilize the shoulders, which I'm surprised Pete, even with tears, which I'm surprised mm-hmm. Pete doesn't use more, is a lot of shrugging and a lot of face pulling, and that creates a stabilization by developing the rear delts and the traps. And usually makes an enormous difference from an athletic performance standpoint.
And not only that, like you just stated, it's the front. Well, I got news for you. A real lifter that's got some size, when you look at them from the side, is where you're going to be able to tell what they are. You know, it's like you're not much if I'm looking at the side and you're just like, there's nothing there. You know, and nothing looks better to me than, you know, traps to me and neck are always a sign of strength. I mean, you know, if you got clothes on, which most of us do, because if you don't out in the road, there's a chance you're going to get arrested. But when you're looking from just above your clavicle down and you're seeing somebody with a neck and traps, that's telling me something right there. You know, whether it's athletically or they did play athletics at one time. And with the stabilization of the joint, because let's face it, you and I both know when you got a large dumbbell or you're doing a clean and press, the amount of explosion that's going on in the body, you know, and the ability to have accidents could become, quite prevalent with most athletes.
Absolutely.
Why do you think it is that people don't? Is it a case they don't know? They don't care? What is it? Is it the aesthetics of everybody wants to say, look at me? Or is it they're just ignorant to the fact that it's more than just doing a bench press? How come we haven't figured out yet you need to have rhomboids, traps, lats? What is that, Steve? Why does that happen?
Well, to me, it's just non-glamorous work. So the bottom line is that look at what most people's body image of what an athlete looks like is not looking at the person that actually accomplished what you wanted to accomplish, then stripping them off and taking a look at it. It's more like we have this idea of a guy that is on the cover of Men's Health who has moderate development just in the right places is a person that looks most athletic, but that person in particular is not a person that's going to be able to perform the tasks that you want. And instead of looking at sports and powerlifting and Olympic lifting, although people want to have good physiques, it's not bodybuilding and it's not posing. So you have to create a musculature structure that is going to accomplish the tasks that are before you with the least amount of likelihood of injury. And so I think most people don't want to do it. And secondarily, a lot of people don't teach it. I mean, who does pullovers anymore?
Right.
And any of
who
those
does
movements.
Who does bent rows anymore, Steve?
Exactly.
I mean, and these are movements that will, as they used to say in the old days, they'll put weight on a rake if that's what you want. I mean, you can build some size. That pullover machine that I've got, like you, I mean, obviously, you've got new equipment you designed. I've read horror stories. Don't do them. They'll wreck your shoulders, this, that, and the other thing. Well, I'll tell you what. Number one, the machine fits me, okay? I mean, I'm very tight through the shoulders in it, but here's the point of the matter. I've been very careful with it. I don't overstretch anything. And to be honest with you, as you know, I've got the Nautilus dual shoulder there. I'll tell you what, if you train those things right and, you're not trying to explode 200 pounds on the thing, they're so beneficial. They will. You want to talk about building lats and back? Holy cow, man. When I do those shoulders, when I'm seated and I've got it behind me and I'm pressing that, I dare anybody to tell me you're not getting growth off those. I can use 100 pounds on that thing and go so slow with that. By the third set, you won't even be able to, you won't raise your arms hardly at all with that thing.
Yeah, like anything that somebody's trying to build to fit everyone, there's always going to be some problems there. The machines, I stand by this as a guy that's been in this industry for a long time, were way before their time. They still have an enormous amount of relevancy. I still use them as part of what we do. And the fact that they're still in places and functional and looking at something that's 30 or 40 years old is a testament to the way this guy designed stuff. Secondarily, I mean, I primarily live in the variable method. This guy put the variable method in machines. Is there a way to compound that? Absolutely. But he was way ahead of his time.
And the thing is, those machines aren't cheap. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there that, they're not going to give something like that away. And I was just very fortunate at the time. I mean, I know, you're a big neck guy. I mean, I've got that first generation four-way neck machine. I love that thing. And, there's another thing. You use that, you'll break your neck. Well, really? I mean, knock on wood, nothing's ever happened. But, once again, it is how you use things, how you're going to put things in place and do them. And I'm with you. I think Arthur Jones was way ahead of his time. And I think, you've developed some new stuff that you've expanded, made better. But I think if someone was ever going to buy one of those, I'd encourage you to do it.
Sure, because here's a simple way to incorporate what we're doing, and this is how I do it a lot. So to compound the whole variable method besides the cam, so just say you're going to use triples, and we'll just use light plates. Three pullovers with three plates, three pullovers with six plates, three pullovers with nine plates, go back to three and keep compounding the factor. To be honest with you, for my work scientifically, looking at expanding like even Virco's variable method, the machine warrants itself to even expanding it even farther in ways that neither Arthur Jones or he conceived of, because it's already built into the cam. So at some point you're going to be able to, double and triple the variable method outputs on those things, depending on how you set them up. So I love them. They're a great item.
Now, do the kids there, do they really gravitate to this stuff with Nautilus? I mean, we're talking about injury, but I mean, do you have, is that something, is that a staple, so to speak, in their diet with that stuff?
Absolutely. I don't think they recognize what it is or the significance of it because, I dictate what's necessary for them. I mean, I don't really get any backlash as far as what they're told to do. I mean, I tried to build a gym that had the best of every era in it, but that would have relevancy, that if there was dust settled over here and you walked into the place 20 years later, everything in the building would still be relevant.
And that's the coolest thing, man. It's just like, you've been here, you know what I've got. It's like, it's a, not only is it an honor to have that stuff, but it's a pleasure to be around. It really is. I mean, I was out last night back there. It's just like I wish I could just uproot everything in that back and put it on something and say see you later wherever I'm going next. You know what I mean? It's that much. But on to obviously shoulders. What's obviously, is it elbow joints we're going to hit?
Well, this is one thing I want to say about all the joints.
Yeah.
Because
Go ahead.
I failed to say it besides strengthening it. The movement of them is often inhibited. So if you the important thing from body weight outside of that is that all the joints can be moved interdependently and independently in a figure eight. So there should be no incorporation of the trap and be able to move the shoulder in a figure eight, both vertically and horizontally. And that takes a lot of slow work. But once the joints can work in that way, and a lot of those kinds of circles, every joint from the wrist, the elbow, the shoulder, the knee, the hips, the ankles, and the neck should all be able to be moved in figure eights. Once you have that kind of freedom of joint movement without incorporating any of the other surrounding musculature except that which was in that particular joint, you have different movement patterns and different mobility in those joints that helps a lot, especially when there's possibility of injury during contact or during a mismechanical movement with an implement.
Right. And the whole thing with this is this, you're showing people how to correctly do things. And the main thing I'd be looking for after something like that is what I'm being taught now. Is this something that I can take with me the rest of my life? I'm healthy now. I know if I get in a situation, I could always come back. But now do I have the tools to keep doing what you've taught me? And obviously the answer is yes. And I guess the other question is this, and I know you're not a big supplement guy at all. Do you ever, or will they come to you and say, Steve, should I get on glucosamine or gelatin or any of the stuff that's out there? What's your belief on that? Do you feel that helps, or you tell them to stay away?
So I don't suggest or sell one other additional item. And I do a lot of appointments. It's a strong place, so somebody could easily argue, hey, you could increase your sales by 10 or 15%. I'm a whole foods guy. Eat the best whole food you can. Drink the best fluids you can. Outside of that, I don't. It's necessary for you to drink liquid, obviously, you know, a good protein source mixed up is absolutely fine. I'm a no supplement guy with the exception of vitamin D3 here just because of the lack of sun.
Yeah, absolutely, because we all know what D3 can do for you, and they seem to be coming up with more and more studies on it. Okay, so we've gone through that, obviously. Do we want to tackle elbows here? I mean, do you see a lot of elbow injuries, or is this something that –
I think arm injuries in and of themselves, in what I see, is not so much related to – with the exception of people that bench press incorrectly or press incorrectly, outside of that, from an athletic standpoint, most of it is allowing kids to continue after full fatigue is set in. I mean, if you think about even the velocity of throwing a ball, the power is coming from the ground. Once they start the shoulder throw, any kid should be stopped. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen a lot. That shoulder throw starts to snap the elbow. Then it leads to elbow and wrist issues that usually have a hard time correcting and cleaning up because just the sheer amount of volume that's put on the body.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, when you get to that point, it's usually you're not going to turn back. You can't strengthen something that's just like there's nothing left to strengthen at that point. I found, when I tore that bicep, I had a little bit of elbow stuff going on there for a while. It used to hurt a little bit, not real, not pain hurt, but I was aware of things like that. And those things, same with your wrists. I love doing like big stuff on the wrist machine, but if you're not careful, you blow a wrist, right? You blow a tendon out, you're finished there too, But do you feel, are there movements that you would say that are good for strengthening the joints, like in the elbows? What is there something specific you would work on with an athlete or somebody, coming to your gym?
Well, even that joint, the only thing I would do directly to that, and maybe it's because we really haven't faced a significant enough issue to force me down another path, is the figure eight I was speaking with, I would try to have that figure eight movement done on both elbows in all directions, and then being able to circularly move it. And then outside of that, you know, anything – I always err on the side of caution. Anything that's causing – pain to joints, we cease immediately. I don't get one extra rep, nothing out of it, and I will probably remove the movement from it because there's too many tools to be able to apply the way we strength train to and movements to stay to something that's eroding the joint.
What do you think about, you know, we didn't really get into musculature real heavily. You know, we're talking about joint, obviously, you know, whether it's a thrust or, you know, getting your legs cut out from under you or doing benching for 10 years incorrectly and et cetera, et cetera. But when you find these injuries and you work with people, do you find the musculature is weaker or the same, or can you gauge that with your athletes right away after an injury like that in a rehab?
Well, people that are coming to me for that purpose, I mean, I try to put tissue. There's a lot of bad tissue on people nowadays, in my opinion.
Yep.
So
yep.
They might look like something they're not, but when you start to study the tissue and how it moves and how much tension is built into the tissue, it's creating huge pulls on the joint structures and that getting back to something you said earlier about, you know, the machines causing all this liability and people saying it's funny because I know more people that have been hurt bench pressing and continue to bench press than any other movement. Yet I've never heard anybody arguing that they should sue a guy that manufactures benches.
Absolutely.
So for some reason, some exercises are considered enough of a holy grail that no matter how many injuries they cause and how poorly it's been done in the past, they don't touch it. They continue to do it. And as you notice, the hard lifts, I mean, if somebody's back bothers them a tiny bit or knee bothers them a tiny bit, they'll just say they can't squat anymore, they can't deadlift anymore. But people will wrap their elbows with everything they can find and rub as much horse liniment on as possible to continue to bench so they can tell their friends they hit another, you know, some number. So it's
– Yeah, it's an ego-driven deal. And the thing is, it's like you, that's my least favorite. If I was going to power lift, that'd be my least favorite because – I think the measure, obviously, is a deadlift or a squat. That would be argued. Some will say one or the other. But once again, you know, I'm a guy who believes in the theory of standing up on your own 2 feet. You know, let's face it. We do anything here. You and I both know. The hoose of steel, you're walking. Farmer's walk, you're walking.
Yes.
Yoke, you're walking. So tell me where the I understand, you know, and I think the bench has been bastardized pretty bad. I mean, and you look at those old lifters, Steve, look at any of those guys, you know, before the bench, obviously it was the pullover. You know, you look at these guys, they're in a wrestler's bridge with 300 pounds and a pullover. Are you kidding me? I mean, that to me is functional and real strength. Laying on your back on a pad, I think I can't take that away from anybody. That's strength too, but it's not the type of strength how I define strength.
Well, I mean, it's strength. It's just the movement from its application of besides being applied to just being a great bench presser, which is fantastic. I mean, I have a total amount of respect for the numbers that are being
without a doubt.
You know, but the bottom line is, I mean, if we're looking at it from what I would do in a facility in a gym, it's the thing that I'm least married to.
Well, you don't. I mean, do the kids come in and try to push bench with you?
Oh, it comes up, but the people that I have here now, I've had enough of an impact to shift the culture. The only time we run into issues is you know, combine crap, where unfortunately, you know, that's still a measurement of
strength.
Kids 185 or 2 1/4 for reps, and you know, and it's not even worth explaining even how the fact that the large number of repetitions has little to do with maximum outputs anyway, but it almost warrants not going into until the culture shifts there. You know, you're not going to deal with that. So I, you know, we have the capacity. It's been put in the manuals. We can prep. We do very well prepping that way. I can get people ready. It's just like I said, if you're looking at playing whatever activity or participating in whatever activity, I train specifically for that. There's a whole other cottage industry which is a very lucrative cottage industry that builds their, you know, gets their money on teaching how to sweep the hands and cheat the agility and how to cheat the 2 1/4 and how to cheat the 40 and all those other things. But it's those are artificial measurements because they're not in the same flux that happens in a live game. So I stay away from that stuff.
Yeah, well, and you know, when we talk about combines and 225 for, say, they want to hit 20, 30 reps with it, you want to talk about joint damage? I mean, you could easily blow a joint right out doing that. I mean, it's like anything. If you push it hard enough, and like you said before, maybe we don't go to that next rep, I stop it or I pull it right out of the program, that's usually when people end up getting hurt. It's that last rep that you got to get, and next thing you hear is snap, and you got big trouble then.
Well, it's the tail wagging the dog with the cottage industry. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the longevity of people that have played who have done the most reps with 2 1/4 and have maintained playing time and some longevity in their career, it's very low. So you can start to argue that there's very little correlation to what happens at those combines, with the exception that a lot of people watch, and for a minute it gives, you know,
yeah,
24-hour
good.
Radio
yep.
and news yep. people a lot to talk about. But
well, that's why, you know, one thing always pissed me off is when they took pressing out of the Olympics, and obviously I think it's the same way with it, you're not going to find people that are very good in the press, the majority of them, and I won't say they tried to make it easier, but you know, the guy that's hitting 225 for, say, 20, I would bet you my last dollar they wouldn't clean 225 and press it for 3.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's subject to, you know, who's doing it and what the power output on and all those things. It's the measurement of power that's most important, and the casual eye and the casual reporter can't see what actually needs to be measured by bar speed and all the other subsequent things that take place when you're really looking at structure of force. But it's, you know, it's not worth it to start talking to the general population. What I found is the deeper you get into this, the less ability you have to communicate to people, because this is a fad-based industry, and you only need to show one guy up there who's done decently for himself athletically, you know, drinking some crappy Gatorade and bench pressing, and it's what every kid wants, you know. So
there's something about, they call it commercial dollars. You know, you and I could have the best place in the world, but we don't have the commercial dollars to hide some dolly that's got her abs all in, because chances are she might be doing some chemical stuff, or she's got an eating disorder, and we can go out and push Gatorade or whatever we're going to drink in the bench press, and every kid in your neighborhood is saying, Mr. Helmicky, can I come and train at your establishment, and can we have Gatorade, and will you teach me how to bench press? I can just imagine the look on your face. But that's what advertising dollars will do for you.
Oh, no, there's no doubt, and I don't take any – look, I'm a businessman. I market what I need to market to. But the bottom line is that the scientific validity of things has very little to do with what people elect to do with their bodies, which is strange. But
yeah. What do you think, though? Okay, so we've pretty much gone through the joints and stuff like that. If you're going to put somebody on a program now, I mean, let's face no damage or anything. What are you going to do? How limited or how big will it be? And I know you talked about squatting 3 days a week. If we're getting ready for a sport, good contact sport, how are you I mean, I know you go and look at every individual. I understand all that. What are you going to be your main things? Are you going to be just kettlebelling, deadlifting, squatting, or are you going to just be doing a world of movements that you feel the way you will, I don't want to use the word cycle, but something to that effect where you're going to keep changing. Is that the way you would do it?
Yeah, so I would give you an initial day of, let's say, since we're getting close to basketball season, even though people are talking football, I'll give you an initial day of what like a typical basketball day would be for somebody that is a sophomore in high school that's that has great potential to be a collegiate player. So once we talk about the total knee extension, the standing abs, we do a reverse hyper to warm up the lower back. I put them on a Sorinex product, which is the tilting this tilting stand-up bench where we stretch the Achilles and calves out. Once all of those things are done, we move very dynamically. So the first thing I would do is you'll have a pair of, just say, and this is a typical day and everything would change. So four, a 6 kilogram, 8 kilogram kettlebells, and then in front of them you'd have a pair of 12, 16s, and 24s. A vertical jump with the four, a vertical jump with the six, a vertical jump with the eight, a front squat with the 12s, the 16s, and the 24s. Repeat that complex four times. Bring their heart rate down for about 10 seconds. Hydrate them through sips with filtered water. Bring them right back. The next movements would be, if I had the D balls all set up, I would have so I'd have a 20, a 40, a 60, an 80, and 100. One squat with each of those three times through the sequence. Bring their heart rate down again. Sip them, and I'm talking about 10 to 15 seconds. We use burst breathing. Then right back on. So this is probably going to be a 20-minute workout in total, if that.
Wow.
Move them to move them to kettlebell sumo deadlifts. So now you'll have your 24s, your 32s, your 40s, your 48s, and if it's a reasonably strong kid, maybe your 56 kilograms. A single sumo pull with each of those up the line. Do that complex four times in a row. Bring the heart rate down. Rehydrate them. Go back into the other room. The first set of kettlebells that we've jumped and squatted with, we'd row all those. So we'd take a single row with the 4s, the 6s, the 8s, the 12s, the 16s, and the 24s. Go through that sequence four times. Bring the heart rate down. Water up. Go back to those balls. Bent row the balls. But this time with the balls, since it's an interesting object, I would have them forcibly shove the ball back into the ground without their hands trailing, so none of that contact force goes back in the body, but it's almost a double ballistic movement. A fast row, explosive push back into the ground. Do that sequence three times. Hydrate them. Then I'd use the balls for presses that day. So now you've got your 20, your 40, your 60, your 80, and 100. One press overhead with each of those four times. Bring the heart rate down. Go back to the same sequence of kettlebells that we had sumo deadlifted, so the heavier ones. So we would take five shrugs with each of those all the way up the line. Do that series three times.
Wow.
Rehydrate them. Bring their heart rate down. I play with the shot puts a lot just from a tactile standpoint. We have them all the way up to, I don't know, the heaviest they can get from all the way from 2 pounds. So we would curl those up, a set of two curls with five different sets of shot puts and varying weights, two reps each, 10 times in a row. Hydrate them, bring them down, take a single set of chains, have them curl 20 straight. Put them with the football bar with the close grip on a flat bench just for close grips. So you would take, say, a pair of 10s on each side for four ballistic reps, a set, 20 pounds for four ballistic reps, 30 pounds on each side for four ballistic reps, take it back down to the 10s, the 20s, and the 30s again. Do that sequence three times. I would go to a push down with bands. So you'd have your light band, your average band, and your heavy band, five push downs apiece. Do that sequence three times. Then we would do what's called band starts. So I'd have a sequence of bands around their waist. They would take the first two steps of their run with a light band, an average band, and a heavy band. Do that sequence three times. Heart rate down, sip. Kettlebell swings. So say 12, 16, 24, 32s, five swings apiece in that sequence up and down the line three times. And then I would probably finish them with ropes and chains, the waving stuff I use a lot in combination. So I'd use an inch and a quarter. Individual waving and then together, the 2 1/4 inch individual together, the 3 inch, which is a monster, individual together, then a single chains, and I put the cannonballs in them, that would have 2 inch grip on the end of those, and then a double chain with 3 inch grip, and then I would make you go through that sequence, individual and together probably three times, and then we would do the standing abs again just to stretch out, and then I would I roll every single athlete out, so I roll their IT bands out, their traps out, and their back out, laying on a massage table, basically, and that's all cleaned out. Rehydrate them and get them out of here.
Wow. How long does it take these guys to adapt to a program like that?
A long time. People that don't train this way, even with big numbers, don't do particularly well. Even people that consider themselves tactically trained.
Because this is definitely – to listen to that, that's an eye opener right there. But you know what I see, though, that it's got to create massive energy all through the body, and the muscles have got to be so explosive at that point after you've adapted that type of training, correct?
Oh, and the motors continue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You can keep 80 to 90% of your power output under any kind of duress. The cardio, this is the one thing we've noticed is, and because I'm doing this in programming, I flop back and forth. Mm-hmm. I've been taking some heavier weights. Mm-hmm. You get away from training this way and you try to go back to it, it shows you quickly how out of condition you are. So
absolutely.
You know, my obligation is to put as much conditioning built in and not your typical do circuit shit till you throw up. You know, I want to make sure.
I know.
I want to make
know.
Sure that, you know, what may sound yeah. like very, there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of differences.
Yep.
It's done quite precisely.
Well, you can hear that, you know. Now, what got you into, I mean, I don't remember if we even talked about it when you were here, but, I mean, obviously you're very into the kettlebells. What have you always been? I don't ever remember that, but, I mean, if not, what got you? What I mean, obviously you've used them on yourself, I'm sure, before anything you did with anybody, but what got you so kettlebell-oriented? Was it just the ability for people to use them? It was a little easier for them, or what?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, how I started out is that was one of the elected assistance pieces, both through Pavel and when I trained under Lewis Simmons.
Right.
So it was that was part of it. The thing for me is the fast changes are a necessity to keep the conditioning aspects and get the maximum out of the variable method. So I started, and I also like very concentrated force structures. Some of the mm-hmm. issues with long barbells are, or certain machines that are made to put you in perfect position are, that the weight is distributed over long areas. When you think of a mm-hmm. punch or a push, the force structure is a very concentrated force structure. So that's why I like the balls that are shaped like stones and stuff like that,
right.
because they're very dense, concentrated objects. And when those can be moved rapidly, it really is different kind of firepower.
Mm-hmm.
Because your hands are in closer, your body's in a position where you need to access that kind of power.
Right.
Then I just decided as I was building a facility that I wanted to have everything. So I have a mm-hmm. set of everything from your 4 kilograms all the way up to 203s and doubles.
Wow.
And I wanted to make sure that we had, you know, when you looked at that line of stuff, that we made sure that we had a setup that no one else here or
right.
I know of was going to have. But I use any I'm more about – I think – for a minute, the industry, because you have to sell equipment because where the money is,
yeah.
the equipment started to precede the methodology, and the exact opposite, in my opinion, as a strength coach has to happen. You have to find a methodology that you think is the most effective and then fundamentally apply that to the correct implements.
Yep.
Now, how I used it across the barbell, and the problem for me is I haven't built the rack yet, is and what I would do is I would run 10 barbells.
Right.
So I'd almost have an X rack where there was five barbells on the side. That way, if I had one set to 135, one set to 185, one set to 2.25, one set to 275, one set to 315, and so on, now I could mm-hmm. sequence what I wanted to do variable method style off that. And I will say this much, that is even worse conditioning than the smaller implements. The times that we've
mm-hmm.
done it with a barbell, you take one mm-hmm. rep of each of those 10 squats and you do that complex 3 times. I don't care if you start
yep.
with the bar and
yep.
you're moving the stuff as fast as possible, you're going to be exhausted.
Yeah, you're out of gas for sure. Do you you do much with dumbbell training at all?
Minimally. And that's just because I the way I'm set up, I don't have
yep.
the full line. I want to manufacture the globes again, and if I can
wow.
manufacture the globe dumbbells again in a full sequence, I will run the globe dumbbells.
Are we talking solid globes or
solid.
Ones you fill a shot? Oh man. I got some of those York ones sitting in there. Who knows? Maybe Grimmick was using them at one time. I always think that when I look at them every time I go out there. That would be incredible if you brought those back out.
And I hope to. I've been trying to get somebody to cast
wow.
them. I have a nice, beautiful collection of stuff, but it's in the lobby, and I don't really let people play
yep.
with it. But I love them, and I would do the same thing with the barbells, you know, fixed and precast.
Wow.
So it's just once that happens, I would then I would really run people through that. But it's
Dude, that would be incredible, man. All that old – oh, man, it's nice to hear people talking the way we're doing now. It's that's an era that's been – I mean, people don't realize the stuff that was around back then. Oh, I just love that kind of stuff, Steve.
It was harder work. I mean, if you pick up globes. Yeah. There's no doubt. I mean, I have a couple. Yeah. I have a pair of 85 globes here. I mean, to me, they're like 120s of regular stuff.
Oh,
you know, I mean, you put that crap in your hands, you're like, wow, these guys did some real labor with this stuff.
Yeah, and you know that's what it was. You know, I kind of when we lift stones and we'll walk them 15 feet, and it doesn't matter at that point. I can't remember how many stones I've got now, and we call it like the hard hat workout. And it's like you got to pick them up, drag them, whatever you got to do, and we bring it to the one corner of the garage, and you got to pile them up.
I love it.
And you want to talk about a workout, man. That shit will knock you right on your can like nothing. And that's how I kind of equate what we're talking about with the, you know, the globes or whatever else you want to get into, you know, solid lock bars, all that stuff. I just think there's a style, a difference of not only gain-wise, musculature, but I really think mentally it makes you a better animal for sure.
Absolutely.
And I love it. I applaud you for that. Holy God.
Well, it's a
I didn't know
way
you're,
to go. You know, I mean,
yeah, but still, man, it's something nice to talk about and, you know, make this thing happen because, you know, before all the guys leave the earth that know what they're doing, I mean, get a few things out there and let, you know, we educate people and maybe you create a whole new generation, you know? That wouldn't be a bad thing.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? Well, look. We've covered quite a bit today, and you know, I'm glad you're on here, and I thank you. And before we go, I didn't want to cut you off. Do you got anything else you want to ask?
No, I just as always. I mean, I appreciate the time, and I appreciate having the opportunity to pass on, you know, what we're experiencing here, and hopefully people find great benefit from it.
Well, they will, man, because the last show we got good feedback. Why don't you tell everybody the website again and anything else you want pertinent to your business?
Sure. It's primordialstrengthsystems.com. And then the fastest way to you know, to keep tied in is Primordial High Intensity Training on Facebook. It's an open group. There's about 1,300 people in it. I try to post as much as possible. If that style of training that was mentioned interests you, there's enough in there. And then there's always the tie-ins to Milo and Elite FTS and other places we've published, including the Verkhoshansky website, where you can take a look at and get further into using the variable method and apply it for strength training for preparation and for general fitness.
Nah, that's good stuff. And, you know, you brought stuff today about joints and things like that, and these are things I know, you know, maybe it's not as fun as talking about, you know, a 1,000-pound bench, but this is stuff that everyone's going to face. I don't care how good of an athlete you are, there's going to be something like this. So I thank you so much for that, Steve. And obviously Steve will be on next week with us again. We might have a little surprise though. Steve and I and Roger LaPointe might be doing a show together. I just got to shore up a time. And for anybody that's been sending me stuff, which there's quite a few, we're going to talk about the Husa Steel Stone and Iceland, but I can't say that till I find out from Roger. Just to give you something real quick, when Steve helped me with the bicep injury in 08, I wanted to do something real nice for the guy because he helped me out so much. I had my buddy Alex, who's built these stones, build one for Steve. And we had him come down one Sunday. He had dinner, a little bourbon and cigars at the end, and we sent him back up to Buffalo. But I was very happy to do that for him. And the three of us are always joined because we've got the original. Steve's has got the second one in Buffalo, and I've got the third one here at Albany, too. So Steve and I will always be locked together with that. So on that note, this is Eric Fiorello for Steve Helmicki. Someone's sending me stuff all over my phone. It's nuts. I want to thank everybody for being, you know, I want to thank Steve for being on the show. And, you know, obviously you can get a hold of us at FiorelloBarbellCo.com. We're on Stitcher and iTunes. We are Motivation and Muscle. We've got a brand new site. Please go out and check it. You can get a hold of me at FiorelloBarbell@NICAP.RR.com. And we're going to have a lot more stuff down the road. We've got great guests, and we're going to have more. So, Steve, thanks once again. appreciate you on here, and we'll talk to you very shortly. So for Steve Helmicki, this is Eric Fiorello. I want to thank you for listening to the show, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to Motivation and Muscle, the podcast that connected your brain to your brawn. We'll see you next time.